everybody, and welcome back to the Chilluminati Podcast, episode 346. As always, I'm one of your hosts, Mike Martin, joined by my two wonderful co-hosts, as always, Alex and Jesse. I had two names for you today. We're just going in nice and gentle.
My friends,
a smooth
Alex and
slide
Jesse.
In, my friends.
You like co-hosts. That? I don't like how you said a smooth slide in, but other than that, I'm here for it.
You know, I'd rather have that. I'm all right.
Yeah.
Guys. Oh, okay.
Hey, okay. Good.
Yeah.
Good.
What can I say?
How many times do you think that you called us the Leon S. Kennedy of L.A.?
Probably like two or three.
The funny part is it's in the song.
Leon Kennedy and Claire Redfield.
Oh, the outro. I was like, song. What are you talking about? What song are you talking about?
I had no idea what he was.
Guys, welcome.
Welcome.
To Chilluminati. Kind of like, I don't know, like the prank. Element of April Fool's Day is like a sort of like unpleasantness, in my opinion, right? Mm-hmm. Like nobody really loves the pranks, right? Like some people I think love them in a way that like is like a little too much, but other than that, I feel like everybody just kind of their reaction to the pranks is kind of like okay, yeah, and so like
yeah,
and so I didn't really think that we like as Chilluminati needed to do a prank for April Fool's Day, so I don't think so. Like what we did was we just kind of like kind of half did a prank and was like, hey, it's the Boston Baked Bean Boy month on the show. Just kidding, it's not, but it kind of is, but it kind of isn't, but it kind of is, but it kind of isn't. So again, welcome back to like kind of Boston Baked Bean Month, kind of. That's just how I feel. Like I didn't want to prank anybody, right? Like, so I didn't do a prank. I just kind of made it actually a month about Boston. Like we're kind of in a month about New England and Boston. Is that weird? Is it weird that we found ourselves here?
No, I'm trying to follow you.
Like, I think you guys thought just now that I was going to say that I'd pranked you, but I didn't. I didn't prank you. I just find pranks annoying and didn't want to prank the audience. So I didn't prank them. And so we're in a kind of quasi Boston baked bean month. You know what I'm saying? Like it's a casual Friday compared to LA month, which was very rigid, very LA. But like, if you sit back and relax, you will notice that over the next few weeks, you're going to be seeing a bunch of shit about New England. That's just it. That's all that's happening.
Do we question Mathis? Hey, question.
Yeah, man.
For Mathis. Hey, bud.
How's it going?
How long is a month usually?
Ideally somewhere between on average 30 days.
Right. It's the middle of April. And he said it, more weeks?
Yeah, weeks and weeks.
No. So
we're
like
going into May.
Well, the thing about Alex is when he says month, he really means like quarter.
I mean like season. Like 3 months. Yeah, I mean like season.
He means like a season.
So but like month
bean is, boy season.
It's bean season, yeah. It's right, bean.
Okay, all right.
We're like we're out
keep
of,
going, Alex.
No,
we're
yeah, out everything's
of,
great
we're
so
out
far,
of,
Alex.
We're horny alien mantis season, and we're into Boston baked beeson, I guess. Like, I just like bunth. It sounded better than beeson, but, you know, we can say beeson. We're Boston baked beeson.
I'm here for the beeson.
Also,
it's the today, reason for the beeson, dude.
Yeah, beesus is the reason for the beeson.
Yeah, obviously.
But also today, as a like little break from tradition, I'm not going to be promoting our Patreon, which you can find at patreon.com/chilluminatipod.
Wait a minute.
Not only access to our extremely active Discord, but also weekly bonus content with every episode. I'm not going to be promoting that today. Instead, Patreon. I'm going to tell you guys about some other cool stuff you can do that has to do with the Chilluminati. Firstly, Patreon. We constantly read listener stories here on the show. /chilluminatipod. Not just in the listener stories episodes, but also sometimes like in a mini-sode here or there, one of us will read a listener story or in other strange types of episodes, which I've invented over the years. Sometimes a listener story comes in here or there. Those things are all pulled from our completely free Reddit. Patreon. At r/chilluminatipod. It's a great subreddit. All three of us, I would say, frequent this Reddit. I would say all of us are on this Reddit fairly regularly. And it's also a great place to get all of our, like, the playlists that we post on our official Spotify, merch links, if you want to buy the merch, where, you know, anything like that. And any other kind of weird stuff where we're going to, like, put a quiz out there or, like, give the audience something to respond to. It's always going to be on the Reddit. Go on the Reddit. r/Chilluminati Pod. It's run by our Bog Witch and Manchild Wrangler Hilda, who also happens to run our social media, which brings me to my second point. We're not just on Reddit. We're also on Blue Sky and Instagram. Oh, yeah, and TikTok, too. Yeah, don't forget TikTok. Don't forget Twitter. We're there. Don't go on there, but we're there if you're already there. And we actually pay Hilda to run our social media, which means that it is the place. Unless, again, I'm not promoting it, but unless you go to patreon.com/chilluminatipod and get every single episode already with full video. Like, we're recording video right now while I'm talking, and every episode has it on Patreon. But outside of that, which I'm not promoting.
Patreon.
Of course not. Don't.
Yeah. Outside of that, social media is the place where you're going to get free video clips of funny bits from this show. And also, like, genuinely interesting bits of trivia from the show. Also, all with video, all completely free, and that's at chilluminatipod.fm on Blue Sky that you can go to, and at chilluminatipod on Instagram and TikTok and Twitter, I think. All of those. Pick one, pick all of them. Just go follow us, because if you're not, that is yet another way to support your favorite silly mystery conspiracy paranormal showboys. Besides going to patreon.com/chilluminatipod, of course. And you can still go there if you want, but I'm not promoting that today, so I won't. Anyway.
Clock it, Alex. Good job. Clock it.
Welcome to another episode of the show. Today is an Alex episode in that I have written it for you. But sadly, my mysteriousness is currently being dispensed elsewhere. And the only true trick of strangeness I really have for you this week is simply that today's episode is part one of a two-parter, which, of course, on its own is not really that odd at all. But what makes this week's episode kind of special-ish is that it's kind of like a Wikipedia-powered background primer, background info pamphlet that you need to know to understand a much more twisty-turny episode that is like the answer, the possible answer to a mystery question, which we're going to be asking today, right? Like, today you're going to get, like, I went on Wikipedia. I'm going to tell you what happened. I got a bunch of articles. We're going to get a bunch of background on the people and things involved in this. And then next week, like, a crazy thing's going to unfurl. But you're going to know what I'm talking about already because I already went over it today. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, Mathis.
What's up, man?
Hey, what's up, dude?
You know, just sitting here listening to Alex.
Oh, yeah. You okay?
Yeah.
You following along?
I think so. If not, just
I think
smile.
He's going to read us a Wikipedia page.
Sorry. Hey, guys. What are you guys doing in here? Sorry. Mm-hmm. I just came in. I saw the light was on here. And
No. Hang on. I was letting Jesse hit the pipe real quick before we started. Hold on. That's all.
Are you sure? I don't think I've literally ever seen him hit a pipe. Oh, okay. All right. Oh, my God.
Look at the drug dog with the canine units here.
Oh, get out of here, dude. He knew. He's not legal. B-boy. That's all this is. That's all we're going to do today. It's like a light sort of background episode that you need to hear so that next week you can follow along with everything we're talking about. Think of today's episode as like part 0.5, and next week's squeakquel is where we're going to like go it's going to go to
crazy.
You
could just call part 1 and 2.
Yeah. Oh, okay. That's good.
No, this is chapter 6, part 4, section 3, The Revengeaning.
Yeah. Hey, that's a good game. Is everybody subscribed to the Instagram and the Blue Sky now and the TikTok now and the Twitter now? Did you join the subreddit?
Alex, I'm going to blow your mind. They probably are audio skipping and they probably just cut to this point where they're like, talk about it.
They've been skipping forward for like 10 minutes.
Okay, well,
they've caught up and they're like, I don't know what's going on.
All right, for the non-skippers, we're going to announce some new merch next week. So how about that?
That's good.
Yeah.
That was great.
Yeah.
Non-skippers are going to love that.
Yeah. Oh, and they're going to all follow us on all our socials.
Yup.
Guys,
that's how we know you're a non-skipper.
Yep. This, of course, is the story of the 1990 Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum art heist. And it begins 186 years ago, almost to the day.
Oh, my God. 1990 was so long ago, dude. I feel so old.
Isabella Stewart was born on April 14th, 1940. So literally, like, that was yesterday as of this recording, 186 years ago, to a wealthy New York City linen merchant called David Stewart and his wife, Adelia Smith, who raised her as like the mid 1800s version of like a fancy little rich girl in like Manhattan. Manhattan looked like Wild Wild West, the TV show at the time, but it still was Manhattan. And even though it was early, the age of like wealthy, interesting socialites was already like well upon us. It had evolved out of like a sort of like gentlemanly thing to now just like society in general was just kind of like, oh, a show that we put on using ourselves. Like it's like the prequel like, to like branding. You know what I mean?
I like Jesse would thrive in like this era.
As a rakish, whatever, as a rakish Victorian man. Oh my God.
He'd run the block of wherever
somewhere,
he lived.
Somewhere like, I don't know the rules.
I'd be a begging poor man on the streets and Jesse would be top.
Oh, I'd have like a curly waxed up mustache.
He would.
And I'd be selling all the oils, snake and otherwise. Yeah.
You think red hair was even more rare back then?
You're in a photo somewhere.
Jesse's immortal is what we will learn by the end of this.
You've been shined in.
I told people when you meet me, I suck your energy. No, they think it's hilarious. They're like, oh, what are you?
Suck your energy, bro. You said that like Daniel Plainview. I suck your energy. She's like a little girl who's going to become part of that like socialite society that's crazy and you got to be interested.
She's going to become a little woman.
Yeah, you got to have prospects. You got to have like things going on, things to talk about, right? And she would need to be fully prepared to have that lifestyle. So to cultivate an interest in the arts and other intellectual pursuits for their young daughter, amazingly, in the 1800s, even though she was 8 years older than Belle Starr, this person that I'm talking about right now, like that was also unfolding at the same time for other women, was people like Belle Starr in their life. This woman was like from ages 5 to 15, she attended like a girls' academy for the study of French and Italian languages, art, music, and dance, which is funny because I feel like today most rich dudes would rather their girlfriend be like dumb as fuck than have anything going on in their heads, which is, you know, a change in society that, you know, sometimes you can't expect by looking at history.
I just don't, man. Don't you want like somebody you can sit down next to on the couch and converse with?
I do.
Like,
I do.
Isn't that like,
but some,
you know,
people
like,
I think want like a something between like a Uber Eats person and like a sex toy. I don't know.
Yeah. They always look at women as people or as equals.
Yeah. I want a woman to break me. Is that on the menu?
That's
I think I've known this about you for a long time. Jesse.
Some sort of big barbarian woman. Yeah.
I think you got to pay extra for that, but that's why we have the $10,000 tier. Yeah. That's why
who'd you romance in Baldur's Gate 3, Jesse?
Oh, Karlach, please.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, that's exactly.
She
correct.
And I they ran through the answer. Gates of hell and murdered demons for eternity.
Yep,
ride or die, dog. Yeah, come on.
Who's your favorite? Who's your favorite character from Resident Evil Village?
From Resident Evil Village,
fucking the what's his name? Hammerman, the
I
guy with Metal
you guys
Man.
I was going to say the big lady. Anyway,
yeah, I mean she's
comment. On it, look, I'll be real. I'm gonna tell you something. Look, big lady, great. But three fly girls, better.
Oh, that's right. That's
three
right.
Three vampires who actually flies,
the fly girls
better.
From In Living Color.
In Living Color. Same, you know what? Same vibe. Yes.
Anyway, the only reason she didn't stay in this like girls' academy for assassins or whatever it was past the age of 15 was because
the red room.
Yeah. When she turned 16, her whole family decided to like go to Paris. Where in a strange reversal of like every child in Santa Monica and the various Playa and Marina del Reyes of Southern California, she was enrolled in a French school where children sometimes spoke English, which is the opposite of how it is here. And while there, for the very first time, she encountered members of the Gardner family, who was another bunch of like cultured rich people, except instead of New York, they were from Boston. And she particularly made friends with Julia Gardner, who was a classmate who was like close to her in age. And, you know, they just were like, oh, are you a rich girl? And oh, me too. Oh, let's hang out and talk about our
rich
books.
Girl. Rich people laugh at the poor together. It's so fun.
Yeah. The next year when she was, well, that's not what they were doing. That's the thing that's crazy. When she was 17, she first traveled to Italy, since she was also raised with like quite a religious background, as a lot of people had at this time. You know, superficially or not, like, I don't know how religious she was on a personal level, but she definitely had the knowledge. So this was like a crazy art pilgrimage, this trip to Europe for her, and getting to see all these like real deal period churches and like legendary art pieces, like that you could only read about in books. Like, there's no really like great photography that can like convey a painting across the ocean yet. So this is her chance to go see, like, you know, the ceiling of the fucking Sistine Chapel, shit like that. And so it was fucking crazy of her. And I think most specifically, her biggest mind blow came when she visited the current site of the Museo Pol di Pozzuoli, which actually opened after World War II as a museum. But at the time was the family palazzo, which housed the collection of Renaissance art collector Gian Giacomo Pol di Pozzuoli and his mother, Rosa Trivulzio. And here's a link. This is going to be in the show notes. There's a lot of show notes today, guys. This link's going to be in the show notes. This is a like sort of look at the entryway of this museum, and you can kind of click around and see what kind of stuff's in the museum. This is like one of those Google Arts and Culture things. It's really cool. It's obviously
immediately my I'm opening this up, and you just have the statue of cherubs on this like
the staircase.
Deco art piece with like, yeah, the staircase. And my immediate feeling is this shit's haunted.
Yeah, Resident Evil 8, dude.
You know what? That is a vibe. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Is it not? Is that not the vibe of this red staircase, this like warm orange, everything? I'm just like, oh, there's ghosts here.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? Mark this, because actually that's like a great, we'll do like a fun contrast. So this is the Museo Pol di Pozzuoli. This is a art collection, family art collection, which
sounds like a delicious dish.
I was going to say, it sounds like something I'd order.
Yeah, I know, Museo, right? Pol di Pozzuoli, please.
Because Pozzuoli is like, Pozzuoli is delicious, but Pozzuoli is different. But this family, they're part of an old military family, dates back to the Middle Ages. They'd been collecting famous works in their family home for many years, Renaissance art. But maybe 10 years before Isabella arrives, around 1846 or so, they start to like realize what they want to do with it. And they start to redecorate the place to be centered around presenting the artwork, right? Instead of it being a house, like mostly they're like turning it into like a place to install art for viewing, right? And most key for Isabella's purposes also, the decor in the house, they ceased to have like unified decor in the house and tended toward individual rooms that were like decorated in various styles that would like match a theme.
Oh, so like little thematic rooms. You know what? Yeah. I've always wanted to do that.
Yes.
But I feel like you have to have a ton of money to pull that off.
Well, you just need the art to curate into those configurations is the thing that's really the thing that was attractive to Isabella, is the idea that these people were buying this stuff and arranging it and coming up with like narratives and like thematic reasons. Like museums actually, like if you look into the history of museums, are really quite interesting things, right? Like before we had like consensus fact, and before we had like like a sort of like way that all the global academics could like confirm things with each other, like museums were just kind of like cool shit that we found, come look at it, and like who's the cool guy that you can get, that you can pay. Because there's no cynicism with rich people and money at this time. This was the time when rich people were also paying all the great artists to just like make shit because they're awesome, right? Patreon.com/ChillMoneyPod. And like, you know, because of that, you get the sort of like shape of museums that we have today is just sort of like a formalized version of the eccentricity of extremely cultured rich people.
Yeah, I mean, really, most big museums, the art that's there is lent to them because it's safer to have it at a museum than in your home.
Right.
And so the rich will just like, they'll do the same thing. They'll be like, yes, I had Goop Master 69, famous street artist, paint me this thing, but it's worth $1 million. So I'm not going to keep it at home. I'll lend it to this thing. So the public gets to see it, but I get it safe there because security and this and that and all that. Yeah.
I was watching How To with John Wilson on HBO, which if you have not watched that, Chilluminati listener, I have a theory that if you Vibe With My Mind. You will like that show. But they're doing like some kind of like, it was about like keeping stains off of shit or something was like the topic that he like started with. And he ended up finding like people who would like buy these like expensive pieces of art and then just store it and then do like a print and like hang it in their house.
You gotta have triples, dude.
Like, why do you want? Why even own it? All right. Anyway,
that's like in a weird to the gaming collector analogy. It's like buying a copy, an N64 copy in box, complete, sealed, and then buying a repo cart.
Yeah, but it's like that if there was only one of the real game, which is why it's weird. Like that's why it's weird to me because it seems like the whole thing is about having copies, right? Like having a copy. If you're going to consume it as a Johnny person, unless you're going to own it, I don't know. Anyway, this sort of concept of viewing and presenting art in this way is what gave Isabella her life's dream and purpose. Okay. And after she left that place, she was always known to say that one day, if she ever inherited a serious amount of money herself, that she would make something just like this and open it to the public for people to enjoy. Think about this. This is what a person who said, if I get rich, I'm going to like just make culture better. That's crazy.
Would be nice.
I mean, there used to be a time where the ultra wealthy would not hoard their wealth. They would like
spend it.
They would genuinely be still the same assholes the ultra wealthy always are, but they were smart enough to be like, we should build a few museums and parks and shit that the public can use so they won't come kill us. You know what I mean? They're right. If we give back in a gesture, a wing to a hospital, people won't come murder me.
I know you know this, Jesse, because you're a history guy, and same with you, Alex, but like for the listener, having rich people do that took the Gilded Age coming to an end with people basically threatening to just like revolt. And we're starting to see a lot of warehouses mysteriously catching on fire recently.
Not far from here.
That's what I'm saying. It's crazy. Like how
seven total so far?
Because the wealth disparity now is worse than the Gilded Age, is worse than when the French Revolution happened. It's like the worst it's ever been. And they're removing things. So, yeah, this is just what happens when the wealthy realize, oh, they're going to kill us.
I mean, and you can see people like, you know, the Rockefellers and Carnegie and like, all these guys were just like, we should really invest in not being murdered. So let's just build libraries and bridges and parks. And like, people are like, lovely. And they got something out of it because they got to go to the libraries and the bridges and the parks and it had their name all over it and it felt great. Instead, now people put their name on stuff and it's like, I didn't earn it or deserve it, but my name's going there.
Yeah.
F off. And you're like, I will burn that building down. Like, how dare you?
Didn't Sam Altman in a recent interview say maybe people should have 30-hour work weeks in universal healthcare if they work their 30-hour work weeks? Didn't that recently come out in an interview? Like, maybe. Yeah. That's a good start, but let's keep pushing that negotiation a little further, shall we?
Yeah.
Dude, let's just join the EU.
I'm down.
Anyway, sidebar to that conversation. Is it wild of me to imagine that people didn't get nearly as distracted by shit as they do today also?
And like, I mean, there was like less to get distracted by.
But like, but also I just mean like reinventing themselves and shit way less. Like this lady went on a trip when she was in basically high school and was like, one day I will get rich and I will make a museum for all people. And then like, obviously I'm going to tell you that's exactly what she just did. Right. Like, and like, to me, like the fact that like a kid had that dream and followed through on it through their entire life, I feel like that doesn't happen anymore because you keep having to like reinvent yourself all the time to like fit in with culture nowadays.
Well, she's also rich.
Yeah. I was about to say, she's also, she has the money to be like, I can be whatever I want.
That's the other fucking thing. Like, was it common in the 19th century in America for women to imagine that they might be in charge of a shitload of money one day? Or was that like some woke ass trait of her family? Or is that just like, were there like that type of liberal at the time?
Oh, for sure. But they were like probably in the same category as witch. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right. It's just weird. It's just weird. In the 19th century that this lady's like 17 years old and she's like, one day when I may be rich and not like one day when my husband may be rich. You know what I mean?
I see what you're saying. I do wonder too, because like, you know, I wonder how common it was to more of the poor or middle class or whatever you will call it back then. Because like for today, I do wonder if like people do have these dreams, but they don't go through with it because it's fucking impossible. Like money wise, if they don't have the money to follow through on their dreams, whatever their dreams may be, then they have to readjust. They have to reevaluate once they turn 20 or 30. And there is no path to a wealth level that allows them whatever their childhood dream was.
Right.
Like then, cause I'm childhood dreams for me never happened because just money. Cause it's like, I would love to do that, but I need to be 100 millionaire, like to even like even think about being able to develop a game or something with like, you know, a
nowadays,
studio.
Yeah. Because there's so much brutality that must occur and you're so disadvantaged every turn. But yeah, I guess like at this time, there's probably like shitloads of optimism. And it just kept on going like through, well, we had that like dip for like 20 years and then we come back because we, oh my God, luckily we're like a geographically isolated superpower that defeated Hitler and we're 20 years old and we have a driver's license now, you know, like,
yeah,
I feel like the idea of being an American who's rich at this time just felt like the world was your oyster maybe. And maybe even it was even the women felt it, you know, maybe.
I mean, America in this time also had a wealth tax.
Right.
Like we were before Reagan came in and ruined all that shit. Like there was a wealth tax on like, you know, however many millions you were making, anything after that got taxed 70, 80, whatever.
That rich people had to help you and they fought to not.
And the country boomed because of it.
Yeah, exactly. We had the best years of our lives.
One of the biggest mistakes of my life was trying to major in history and learning too much.
Oh. Man,
too educated in the history of America.
No problem.
I specifically took U.S. history. It was like my special interest. And man, it's made me sadder as like time has gone.
What do you mean? Greatest nation on earth. Shut up.
I was going to say, what do you think about history, Jesse?
No comment.
Yeah. Isabella's. I mean, she just was like really interesting. And I just wonder if this is how all rich women were. She's so like actualized and like self-motivated and it's like really awesome to me. And I just like, I don't understand if she's like
an anomaly.
Yeah. Or if she's like how these people were, was it just like a really intellectual woke ass golden age time for these people?
I think maybe it's probably more about her parents and what their desires were for her. Because it seems like they were pretty much follow your heart, dear. But I know a lot of parents would be like, I mean, you know, cause like if you're rich, then, and if, is she like an only child? Cause if she's an only child, then I can see her parents being more like, do what you do, baby girl, compared to if she's like the fifth child and you know, the one girl, or maybe there's like six girls, you know what I mean? All that factors in. So I think what her parents would have wanted for her.
Right. I don't think she has any siblings or she does.
Then if
she
she's a single child, then she, I can see how they'd be like, you're our kid. Cause like if you're,
maybe that's what it is when you're rich. Five, this time. Yeah.
There's like four sisters. You're probably in the, we're going to marry you off and try to get richer range. You know, like we'll marry into another family. But if you're the one girl, they're going to be like, no. You have our last name. You are going to carry on our legacy. Don't let some like schlub ruin it for our family. Like that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I don't see any sort of mention of any siblings. She has a grand niece and her spouse and her parents. I'm not her biographer.
Of course. Yeah.
Like this. I'm telling you this as that. Background. I'm telling you this as background to a heist.
Yeah. Yeah.
The stuff.
No, it's just interesting. It's just interesting questions that kind of arise out of it.
Yeah. The stuff that I did read is like, she just seems really interesting. And so I was just kind of fascinated by where she fit into the tapestry of things at the time. But anyway, she's 18. Her family returns to New York because they probably didn't like get rid of their house or anything. I think they just like had a place in Paris for a while. Eventually, her friend from school in Paris, who's also back in America, Julia Gardner, invites her down to Boston to hang and shoot the shit and talk about like fucking books and philosophy or whatever the fuck these girls were talking about. But what she actually ended up doing was meeting Julia's older brother, Jack, who was actually one of the most eligible bachelors in Boston. And shortly thereafter, they get together, which almost 2 years later leads to them getting married at Isabella's family church, which is Grace Church on Broadway in Manhattan, still there. And then Isabella's father, who was also insanely rich, remember, it's not just the Gardners who are rich. Isabella Stewart, the Stewart family is also rich. He gave them a house at 152 Beacon Street in Boston, which they tried to start a family in. It's like one of those big, beautiful, sort of like townhouse looking things that looks like an entire apartment building, but it's like an old house. If you don't know exactly what I mean, there's an article about it in the show notes that you guys can read. But if you guys want to click on it now, you can see like a picture of it and see what the vibe was. Huge fucking house.
Oh, yeah. This is huge, huge house. Holy crap. It's just.
Wow.
Looks like two towers, the squishing a house in the middle. It's crazy. It's three stories.
It'd probably be like a duplex now or some nonsense or yeah, apartments.
At least. Yeah.
It's also known as Green Hill.
Yeah. Dude, she also is Dr. Robotnik. Yeah. Their first son they had was born in 1863, and he died of pneumonia before he was 2 years old. And then a year later, in 1866, she tried again, and Isabella suffered such a catastrophic miscarriage that her doctors told her that she was no longer going to be able to have children, which was devastating to her. And shortly thereafter, coincidentally, her best friend slash sister-in-law unexpectedly passed away. Basically, like, everything she thought was going to happen wasn't going to happen, and her best friend died. And so she just, like, got super depressed for a fucking year and didn't do shit for a year.
Damn.
However, luckily, she was still super fucking rich. And so, after seeing several doctors, they loaded her on a boat back to Europe on a literal stretcher, along with her husband, Jack. And for a year... though they mostly stayed around Paris, they also went around to parts of Russia, parts of Scandinavia, and she like found herself and Eat, Pray, Loved and started scrapbooking, I kid you not. And wouldn't you know it, eventually, with no responsibilities and just being on permanent vacation in Europe for a year, she started to feel much better. And when she came back to New York in 1868, she quickly became one of the city's hottest, most well-known, most interesting socialites, and just like her childhood at French finishing school dictated, her reputation preceded her pretty much everywhere she went from then on in her life. Pretty crazy. A few years later, now at the top of her game, Isabella and Jack take another victory lap through Paris in 1874, and miraculously, but also kind of like fortunately, it's not, I don't want to say miraculously, it's like tragic, miracle, good for some, bad for others. In 1875, Jack's brother Joseph randomly dies out of nowhere and leaves behind three young boys who Isabella eagerly adopts, which like fulfills her desire for children, right? She's like, I will take care of these boys as if they were my own. I will do everything for them. And so it's 1875. For a decade about, she dedicates her lives to raising these boys who are like already, you know, pretty they're all a few years old, and so they all she gets them to manhood, gives them good lives, sets them up. She swears that, you know, they're all gonna turn out well and they're all sort of like independent people. So the moment they're able to get out of the house and she's on her own again, boom, motherhood done. Her and Jack go back on the road immediately, like never lost the lust for travel. Travel all around the globe in the name of art, across more than like a dozen trips, adds up to a total of 10 years abroad. Because I guess when rich people travel in the 1800s, they just like, where are we staying for 4 months? You know, like whatever, like, yeah. Which honestly sounds fucking great. But somewhere in that decade on the road, not exactly sure when, they begin buying art just for the joy of it and for having fun with it. And if you want to see, here is a painting of Isabella by the famous artist John Singer Sargent from 1888. You'll be able to see this in the show notes. But there's a painting of her, so you can kind of see what her vibe was around this time, because this is her
very realistic painting, actually. Yeah, that's crazy. Late
1800s of her, like, sort of post children doing her thing around the world. She seems like chill. I don't know. This is a good, I like this painting.
Yeah, it's a very, very good painting.
Yeah, this painting is on display at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. When her father died, and she inherited $1.75 million out of nowhere. Ooh. He had like a stroke. This was in 1891. So $1.75 million in 1891.
A lot of 1891 money.
That's like $60 million today. And it went from like flights of fancy art collecting to like serious art collecting. And she kind of like was like, okay, I have a European focus now. I'm like going to collect European art. She still dabbled in Egyptian, still dabbled in Chinese and Turkish. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. But that's what happens now. She like in the late 1880s into the early 1890s, she matures into this sort of like world traveler, art collector, wizard person. And here's another painting of her by another famous painter, the Swedish artist Anders Zorn. This is a picture of her in Venice 6 years later. And in the first painting, she's very like low key and she's wearing a black dress. And in this painting, she has like a big, huge piece of jewelry on and it's late and she's standing on the balcony and she's lit from the front and she looks like she's been partying and that she's
what
like,
year was this?
The painting also feels more ethereal than the other one.
Yes. 1894.
It has such like a 1920s flapper vibe to it.
Right. Yeah. Because she's so ahead of her time. Honestly, genuinely.
Yeah, probably.
She's like worldly. And suddenly by the turn of the century, suddenly the gardeners are some of the foremost collectors of art in the entire world. They've accumulated a good mix of what Wikipedia described as, quote, primarily paintings and sculpture, but also tapestries, photographs, silver, ceramics, and manuscripts and architectural elements such as doors, stained glass, and mantelpieces. Mm-hmm. So she's got a huge kind of crazy collection of shit at this point. And around the same time as this is all popping off on all cylinders, in 1896 now, the gardeners start to realize that the enlargement they'd made to their home on Beacon Street would not be enough to literally fit all this shit in it. But they didn't know what to do about it, and they were kind of dragging their feet because they had like all their normal worldly concerns to worry about as well. But then 2 years later in 1898, Jack Gardner, her husband, dies of a stroke out of nowhere in December. Damn. Right before Christmas, and it galvanizes her to like finally try and make her dream of this like beautiful place where the public could view her collection. She wanted to make it come true. So she purchased land in the like swampy area of Boston that's called the Fenway, and hired the architect Willard T. Sears of the studio Cummings and Sears.
Wait a minute. Dude, I've been to this place.
You've been to the museum
in Boston.
Yeah. This is a very famous museum.
Like almost 5 years before COVID, like 2019, 2018. I walked over there and went in and like looked around the, I did none of this clicked until right now.
Boom. There you go.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. We're going to look at it right now. Actually, basically he was like a significant, like local Gothic and Renaissance revival architect. And he did a lot of stuff around Boston. And so he basically was like, she used me as her hands to like kind of design exactly the thing she wanted to design. And basically it's like a big square building centered around this big open courtyard. And you can't really tell what it looks like from the inside, like on the inside from the outside. But if you look at this, crazy. It's like a glass covered courtyard. And it's like,
it's so cool.
It looks like it's from 500 years ago in Europe, but it's like, you know, from the turn of the century.
Yeah. Look, so you walk like there's a beautiful outside garden area. And then this is the interior. So when you walk in, the first floor literally is this courtyard. And then there's these different areas you can go look at around the outside. And then the rest of it is you go up the second, third, fourth, and there are all these different wings of art. Yeah. This place was awesome, dude.
Yeah.
This has blown me away that I've been here before.
Awesome. and it's very like very much like the what's it called, the British Museum in London, that it's like of the old tradition of museums that I was talking about earlier, like where you can just kind of like stuff is just sort of like arranged together. Like obviously the British Museum now is like a modern museum and has a lot of areas where a lot of the stuff that the United Kingdom has stolen from various countries over the years that they used
to
like
liberated.
Right. Mm-hmm. And like just like like now it's like a much more like a modern museum, but there's one wing of it that's like a big room that's just stuff sort of clumped together in like slightly logical ways. And that's very much the vibe of the Gardner Museum. It's very surprising. Like it's very much like a treasure on the inside from the outside. Like you wouldn't, if you didn't know it was a museum, you wouldn't suspect it looked like that. Originally, the first floor was meant to contain like a large music room, which spilled up onto the second floor on one side, with most of the second floor and the third floor primarily intended to be galleries. But eventually, thanks to the giant painting El Jaleo by John Singer Sargent, the same guy who did several paintings of Isabella herself, the room was split, and now there's paintings down on the first floor too. Look at how big this painting is, El Jaleo. I'm going to send, you'll be able to see it in the show notes. This thing is huge. It's 93 inches by 138 inches.
Yeah, it's beautiful though. It's crazy.
Beautiful painting. The lighting in this painting is unbelievable.
Yeah, it's like really well done.
Like this would be so striking to see in real life at that size. Like a movie poster from a movie theater is 30 by 40 inches, just so you guys know. And for you people in Europe, that's 237 centimeters by 352 centimeters. That's a big boy.
Yeah.
And eventually, what was left was an exquisitely and privately curated and installed collection, which represents the viewpoint of Isabella Stewart Gardner herself as a student of art and culture, and which fully fulfilled the dream that she'd held since she was a little girl in Italy over 25 years earlier. And eventually, on January 1st, 1903, her residence at Fenway Court held its private opening, celebrated by a performance from the Boston Symphony Orchestra and including like refreshments like champagne and donuts. And I do call it her residence because she lived up on the fourth floor of this museum for the rest of her life until she died.
Man, though, that's got to be so awesome. That'd be so sick to live on top of the museum of like your passion that
you can visit all this stuff. It's cool as shit.
Yeah.
Extremely eccentric behavior, but I love it. As somebody who has a giant collection right behind him in frame right now.
Same.
Extremely, extremely hilarious and that this happened in such a... I don't know. This is like so legit to me. I don't know. So legit. So that happened. She lived up there. A few months later, it opens to the public. In 1919, Isabella Stewart Gardner, the New England art wizard in her magically curated castle museum, she plucked straight from her own dreams, had the first of several strokes that she would have over the next 5 years. And on July 17th, 1924, at the age of 84, she eventually passed away on the premises and was buried in the Gardner family tomb at Mount Auburn Cemetery in Watertown in Cambridge, Mass. I believe that's one place. I don't know enough about Massachusetts to tell you about Watertown in Cambridge. Do you know about that,
Mass? I know a little Cambridge. I'm not super familiar, though.
It says it's in Watertown in Cambridge.
Yeah.
So maybe they're next to each other and it spans both? Is it a place called Watertown in Cambridge?
Watertown is a city in Middlesex County. It's not Cambridge.
Don't know why it's called
Watertown.
It's in Watertown in Cambridge. If you go to Mount
Auburn
Cemetery.
Maybe it's like a section, like, that's Watertown. It's Watertown.
I don't know. Maybe if you're from that part of Massachusetts, you can tell me. Mathis is from New England, but he's from Providence.
He's not from Watertown.
I lived in Rhode Island most of my life.
Yeah. Here's a painting of her also in her fourth floor home in 1922, 2 years before she died, by John Singer Sargent again. This was after she'd had some of her strokes, but this is like her vibe as an older woman. Like I said, very eccentric, sort of wizardy.
The vibe is? Brando and Dr. Moreau.
Yes, yes. She looks like the negative of a Bene Gesserit also. She looks here's a quote about her legacy. Who wants to read it?
During Gardner's lifetime, she welcomed artists, performers, and scholars to Fenway Court to draw inspiration from the rich collection and dazzling Venetian setting, including John Singer Sargent, Charles Martin Loeffler, and Ruth St. Denis, among others. Gardner also occasionally hosted artist exhibitions within Fenway Court, including one of Anna Coleman Ladd. Today, the museum's Contemporary Artist in Residence program, courtyard garden displays, concerts, and innovative education programs continue Isabella Gardner's legacy.
Yeah.
The artist in residence is like they live there.
Yeah. Yeah. That's actually sick. Like a more recent thing, but it's very much in the spirit of like how she wanted to do things, where it's very much about not just, you know, buying and owning the art, but curating it and interacting with it and having it be created and have it be alive. Yeah. It was very cool. Upon her death, a $1 million endowment was created to support the museum and included the stipulation that her art collection should be placed on exhibition permanently, quote, for the education and enjoyment of the public forever. And that's if awesome. Anybody ever tries to start, change anything, she'd like, all of it gets like donated and sold or something like that. It's like a fail safe. There's no way to like get this art anywhere besides for the public.
That's cool.
She also appointed her secretary, Morris Carter, who had also been the librarian at the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, to be the museum's first director. And they too lived up in that residence on the fourth floor. Isabella did, and indeed, so did every subsequent director, who each worked to catalog the collection, write books, do biography of Isabella, start scholarly publications, like we said, the Artist in Residency Program, until Anne Holly became the director in 1989, because by then we're like basically in the modern day, and she declined to live there because it's kind of a weird thing. Kind of an eccentric thing to do, to live inside of a museum. But she was a legendary director of the museum. And her legacy, she just stepped down in 2015, that director, Anne Holly. But it was just within 6 months of her originally taking that position in September of 1989 that the events which made this episode worth doing occurred. And now that you know about this dope museum and the extremely interesting and eccentric lady who created it, let us get into the timeline of the heist which occurred here in early 1990, in which 13 masterpieces, valued together at over $600 million, were lost, including irreplaceable works by Vermeer, Rembrandt, Manet, and Degas, and which, with the help of Anne Holly herself, eventually resulted in reclassification of art theft as a federal crime, and which increased the statute of limitations on such things from 5 to 15 years, thanks to Senator Ted Kennedy, weirdly. One night in early March of 1990, about 2 weeks before the heist, a security guard at the Gardner Museum saw a young guy outside the museum door being assaulted by some other older-looking dudes on his security feed. Okay,
that was just me getting beat that day.
Yeah. Seconds later.
I was four. It was hard in the streets.
You were out there.
You shouldn't be out at night if you're four.
Well, I was planning my own art heist.
Oh, well,
I had heard there was a really sick painting of Elmo in there, and I was going to have it.
I have some questions for you, because seconds later, the guard heard banging on the museum door, presumably from the guy outside getting his ass kicked, begging to be let inside. But the guards are not supposed to let anyone inside the museum overnight for any reason. So he told the guy through the door that he would call the cops for him instead, and the cops were on the way. But what's
I
weird
ran off
is,
after that. I don't like the cops.
Before
they
the cops
me.
Show up, the guard then watches all the guys, including the guy that was getting his ass kicked, all jump into a single car together and drive off.
Damn.
Mathis. So I have some questions for you, Mathis.
All right. I was the mastermind behind it all. I had them beat me up to sell it.
Yeah.
And once they were going to let me in, I was going to take the knife out of the diaper I was wearing and shank them.
This is like, you're like doing some like Stewie, like
this
Stewie
is a boss
OC
baby right here.
Boss baby was based on me.
Baby geniuses, dude. So that happened.
Look who's talking to.
So that happened in early March. But later that month, on March 18th, 1990, at around 1:05 a.m., four people are walking home, like young people, like college age, through the Fenway from a St. Patrick's Day party nearby. It was at like an apartment or something. As they walk past the museum's side entrance on Palace Road, they notice a hatchback parked in a sort of conspicuous place, but they probably wouldn't have thought twice about it if two of them hadn't seen what appeared to be two Boston cops sitting inside of this hatchback, which is weird because it was not a police car. It was like some kind of, you know, little hatchback for like a college student or something. Inside the museum at the same time. That's at 1:05. Similar time. Inside the museum, there's two guards on duty. One is at a desk near the same side entrance door that we were just talking about a second ago, off Palace Road. And the other was off on his round somewhere inside the museum. So there's one guard at the door. The other one's gone. About 20 minutes later at 1:24, two men dressed as Boston police officers walk up to the same door, which is typically an employee entrance, and buzzes the guard at the desk. The cops, or cop-like people, told the guards that they had come because somebody had reported some sort of disturbance on the premises and that they wanted to come in and check it out. The guard says, okay, buzzes them in, which, again, is against protocol. By 1:28 a.m., they had gotten the first guard to call the second guard back from his rounds to the office, which took him less than 30 seconds to get there. And one of the cop guys has told the guard at the desk that he felt he looked familiar. He's like, I think you look familiar. There's a warrant out for your arrest. The guards are like, what the fuck? But unfortunately, they're also like inexperienced, like hippie student, like band playing type guys and not like ex-cops or ex-military guys. So within a few more minutes, the not cops had peacefully subdued these guys and handcuffed them and broke the news to them that, gentlemen, this is a robbery, before leading them down some stairs.
Oh, dang it. They got tricked second time this week, Bob. Fuck.
Yeah. Again,
One guard is led to one side of the basement alone, and he's cuffed to a boiler. And the other guard is led down to the other side of the basement, like across the building, and is cuffed under a work sink. Both of them have their heads, including their eyes and mouths, covered in duct tape at around 1:30 a.m. And then more duct tape is wrapped around their wrists in case they figured out some way to get out of the handcuffs. So now they're like extra fucking tied up. And at this point, the thieves have free reign of the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum collection for the next 81 minutes. Most art thefts are finished in between 5 and 10 minutes. So that is a fucking crazy amount of time.
That's a long time.
Yeah. Luckily, we know a lot about what they did because the museum had a motion tracker following their movements from room to room. And at this point in the story, it might be worth it if I give you a map of the premises to follow along with in case you get confused, because now we're going to get a little bit more specific with stuff. So here's the map from the official site. It's a PDF. This is also going to be in the show notes, but you guys can have it and look at it too.
Third Love makes bras that actually fit, so they know this. If your bra feels uncomfortable, the problem isn't your body, it's your bra. Third Love designs for comfort first. Soft fabrics, support that doesn't dig, pinch, or slip. Bras that feel good and look good under everything you wear. Shop Third Love and explore over 60 sizes, including AA through H, and half cup sizes you won't find anywhere else. Get $15 off your first purchase at thirdlove.com with code PODCAST15.
Normally in these ads, you'd expect someone like me to ask you to buy something. But I want to ask you to do something different. I'm Dave Farenthold, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm an investigative reporter, which means that I follow the money, inside of government and outside of government. The point of my job is to find things people are trying to hide. It involves talking to lots of people. It involves looking through lots and lots of documents. And if there weren't folks like me to go beyond the surface to understand who is really shaping what the government does, the public will be left in the dark about what the government's doing with your tax money, what the government's doing to you through regulations and spending. If you're like me and you think this kind of journalism is important, seek out a news source that does firsthand, fact-based reporting. If that's the New York Times, thank you. If that's your local paper, that's great too, because where you get your information matters.
The first reading we have on the motion tracker is from the landing outside the door of the Dutch room on the second floor. And this is likely because it houses works by the Dutch master painter Rembrandt. Since, indeed, by the time of the Gardner Museum heist, every other museum in Massachusetts with Rembrandts in it had already been robbed at least once.
Crazy.
Yeah. One of the Rembrandts was Christ in the Storm on the Sea of Galilee. That painting looks like this. It'll be in the show notes if you want to look at it. It's Rembrandt's only seascape. It's a very dramatic seascape. You've probably seen it. if you are a cultured individual.
Dramatic, except for the one dude who's super fucking chill sitting in that boat.
I'm pretty sure that's Jesus, dude.
It looks like it might be Jesus.
That's supposed to be Jesus.
Well, because he looks like he's a cartoon compared to everybody else who looks very real.
If you want to link
a little, like,
if you want some trivia,
a little sassy looking.
The face of the, are you guys talking about the sailor that's looking at the camera?
No.
No, the one with the profile shot.
One guy.
No, the one looking at the camera looks like Dopey from Snow White.
Yeah.
Oh, I see the guy you're talking about.
Yeah, the guy who clearly is Jesus.
Yeah, the guy who's looking at the camera, though, little trivia for you, self-portrait of Rembrandt himself.
Oh, love Rembrandt? Yeah. Looks like a little Dopey. I like it.
So they take Christ and the storm on the Sea of Galilee down from the wall, and they also take down a lady and gentleman in black, which is another Rembrandt, which looks like this. It's another one that, like, you've definitely seen it. Very famous image, even though it has been stolen. This one is interesting because x-rays of this painting showed that originally a child was sitting on the woman's leg. This is like a portrait of two people standing next to each other from the 1600s or something like that. But Rembrandt ultimately removed the child because the child died and the people in the painting did not want the reminder of the child who died young to be in the painting forever. So they probably had Rembrandt remove it before he finished it. So then, using a box cutter, the thieves slice both of these paintings out of their frame so hard that it leaves gashes on the supports around the canvas. And they just roll them up. Fucking Rembrandts. They also grabbed another painting nearby called Landscape with Obelisk, which looks like this. And for many years was also...
Damn, that's like a fantasy painting.
That looks like some Dark Tower shit.
Yeah, I was going to say, it looks like the Dark Tower. A book about the museum from the early 70s lists this painting as a Rembrandt. But in 1980, it was determined that this was actually by one of his students. And I'm so sorry, Hilda. His name is Govert Flink.
Govert Flink?
Yeah. So they cut this painting from its frame anyway, probably because they thought it was a Rembrandt. Confusing for profilers what level of art expertise has been ascribed to these thieves over the years. There's just some weird things that they did during this robbery that makes you think twice, because some things you're like, they knew exactly what they wanted and they went right for them. And other things you're like, why the fuck did they take this thing that has already been known not to be a Rembrandt for 10 years by this time?
And they were in there for, like you said, 81 minutes. I mean, that kind of might even speak a little bit to how much they didn't really know what they were looking for if they probably spent that time perusing.
Well, they were also carefully slicing paintings out of their frames and rolling them up, but because they are Rembrandts. They take another giant Rembrandt self-portrait down from the wall, but they decide to leave it because it's big and it was on wood instead of canvas. That's probably why they didn't take it. And then they grab one of the museum's most cherished treasures, which is a beautiful domestic interior called The Concert by Johannes Vermeer. You've probably seen this painting too. It's a painting with paintings in it. Here you go. Interestingly, this painting, it's like a house. It's like a recital in a house. This painting was also fake stolen in a fictional episode of the Alfred Hitchcock Hour in 1964 called 10 Minutes From Now. But then it was actually stolen. They remove this canvas from the frame and they shatter the glass. Also, strangely, located in the Dutch room is a 10-inch tall ancient Chinese beaker-like vessel called a gu. From the 12th century BCE. Though this item is not particularly valuable, at this point, they spend a lot of time trying to remove this goo. They think it's originally attached to this like cloth underneath it. And so they like slice at the cloth and then they find out that it was attached to this like heavy metal base. Mm-hmm. So before they even get it off, they like fuck up this base and then eventually they finally get it off. But if you want to know or see a little bit about this goo, it's here. This is from the 12th century BCE. That's pretty crazy. It's pretty old compared to some of this other stuff, but it is not as valuable.
Looks like a horn almost.
It's like a beaker, like an open sort of like horn-shaped beaker. Yeah. Next, the thieves notice a small postage stamp-sized self-portrait of the artist as a young man etching by Rembrandt. And maybe because they didn't get the big wooden self-portrait, they decided to take this one instead, even though it's the size of a stamp. It's this one. You've probably seen it. It looks like this. And since they know for sure the police aren't on their way, they actually take the time not only to unscrew the frame of this portrait from the cabinet that it's attached to the side of. They also take the time to carefully unscrew each screw in the frame itself and take the little tiny etching, which probably took 5 minutes by itself. They also took down one more Rembrandt self-portrait in a gold frame. But most people think that once they got it down and leaned it up against the wall from the back, the way the backing was, like, the next morning, even the director of the museum herself, like, thought that the painting was taken from the frame when she looked at it. And they think that that's why it got left behind, is because it was, like, on the ground. And if you were, like, scooping up all the stuff that you grabbed, you'd look at that frame and you'd think the painting was already gone from it. Here's a picture of that miracle painting, which survived. It's Rembrandt at 26, I think it is, or Rembrandt at 23. I can't remember how old he is. I think he's 23. It's like, he's quite young in it. Yeah.
Dashing fellow.
Age 23. And, the reason this painting is so, like, miraculous that it was saved is because it was literally this painting that when Isabella bought it, she decided that she would start collecting art for the public instead of herself.
Mm.
So it's like a pretty important painting beyond its worth as a Rembrandt also to this museum. So it's cool that it got to stay. By this point, from when they were first buzzed in the door, 40 minutes have now passed, which is crazy. At 1:51, one of the thieves leaves and heads across the stair hall to the early Italian room and walks straight through it. And the Raphael room walks straight through it, takes absolutely nothing despite literal masterpieces all around them, which makes some people think they had specific goals. But then, you know, sometimes it doesn't seem that way. Eventually, the guy arrives. Just had
specific taste.
Right. Next, the guy arrives in the short gallery, breaks a little glass, grabs five drawings by the French master Edgar Degas out of a cabinet before getting to work on a Napoleonic war banner. So here's the sketches from Degas. Three of them are horses and jockeys, and there's like some musical instruments in there and stuff. You can see them. they're like sketches. Some of them have a little bit of color. They're very beautiful because they're by Degas, but they're not particularly breathtaking as some of this other artwork is. That's why it was kind of in like a cabinet. They're kind of like paneled cabinets with like glass, and they just broke it and took it right out. Like, they weren't even like, you actually turn the pages of the cabinet to look at all the stuff in it. So they just broke that and took it out. Fortunately, the thief seems to have had some trouble liberating the Napoleonic flag. The Napoleonic flag is still hanging in the Gardner Museum. And instead, he decides to settle for the finial on the corner of the flag, which was so inconsequential that the museum did not even notice it was missing until the next day, when the screws from it were found in a fire sand bucket nearby. And here's a picture of the flag with the finial still on it. It's like an eagle. See that on the side of the flag there?
Yeah, I see that. Yeah, I see.
They like couldn't get the flags. They just unscrewed this eagle on one corner and took that instead. So then that guy who does that joins his buddy back in the Dutch room with whatever he needed, he got. So he went back to the Dutch room. They made their way back out, grabbed everything they needed, back down to the first floor. They walked past a set of much more valuable ancient Chinese artifacts on the way, by the way, but just still grabbed the goo only. Back to the side entrance they came in from. It takes two trips to load everything into the car. And just before they leave, they also grab the printout from the motion sensor machine, which was tracking all their movements, thinking that they were getting away clean. However, it was 1990, so they don't know that you can just press print again and it will just print it out again. So that's how we know exactly how they went around in the building. But yeah, after 81 luxurious minutes in which they could do whatever they wanted, they were gone. The robbery was not discovered until staff arrived the next morning at 6:45 a.m. And the poor fucking guards were not found until 8:15 when the police showed up and started actually looking around.
Damn, that's
so they were like that for like 7 hours, which is crazy. And that, my friends, is the first half of the story of the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum heist. But there's one last element of the story you need to hear, because I
aliens.
Said 13.
Is it aliens?
No, I said 13 things were stolen, but I've only mentioned 12. The final piece missing was this one. It was called Chez Tortoni by Edouard Manet. There you go.
A little Chez Tortellini?
No, it's a man in a hat. And it was removed from the blue room on the first floor sometime that night.
It is a man in a top hat looking suspiciously at the proverbial camera.
But the thing that's strange about this one is that during the time of the robbery, the motion detector logged no entrances or exits from this room at all of any kind.
Hmm.
And when they went and they checked the logs, the last person who had been in and out of that room that night was the hippie musician guard who had been sitting at the desk that night, Richard Abath, who had been on the outs with the museum security director already when he worked that shift. You remember that weird fake fight where Mathis was a baby from weeks earlier?
Yeah.
Everybody thought that was the thieves trying a dry run, right? Maybe trying to get somebody to come out. But actually, when they looked into it, it was staff who said that it was some kind of prank gone wrong, but they never quite explained what the prank was going to be.
Huh.
So if the guy who worked at the museum was the last guy in and out of the room where one painting was taken, and that painting's frame was left on the chair of the security director of the museum, and that guy was mad at that guy, that's interesting.
Yeah.
See you guys next week.
Ah, this guy.
All right. We'll see you next time. We got a mini sub to go to over at patreon.com/humanitypod. We appreciate you. We love you. Goodbye.
Bye. Bye.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Chilluminati Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Mike Martin, joined by the... I don't know who they are. There's two.
What?
Terrence Hill and Bud Spencer.
No.
Neo and Trinity.
No.
I don't understand, and I probably never will. Let me just tell you right now that there's two. Kennedy and Claire Redfield.
I'm telling you, I think he literally just looked up famous duos.
Cheech and Chong.
And has just been going through the list ever since.
I'm trying to dig deep. Which one of you is Dick Powell?
Me?
Your name's Jesse Cox.
I want to love you.
Podcast. As always, I'm one of your hosts, Mike Martin, joined by Alex and Jesse. Like a shooting star across the sky that's actually a UFO.